Okay, the meeting of the House Special Committee on Energy will come to order. It is now 3:05 p.m. Thursday, March 24, 2011. It is day 66. I believe that leaves about 24 days left in the session. We're here in the Ramona Barnes Committee Room of the Alaska Capitol, room 124. Members present to my right here, we have Representative Sadler, co-chair, Representative Pruitt, myself, Representative Foster, Representative Lynn, and also Representative Tuck. And we also have here Representative Peterson. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. And please do turn off your smartphones and your cell phones. They do disrupt the recording system. So today we'll continue hearing House Joint Resolution 23, the House Energy Committee resolution that urges Congress to classify hydroelectric power as a renewable and alternative energy source. After that, we will hear presentations on the following two subjects. The first is natural gas potential in the Nenana River, Susitna, Copper River Valley basins, and the Bering Sea region. The second presentation we'll hear is regarding Rural Cap's EnergyWise program. And so first we have House Joint 23. Last Tuesday, Representative Tuck discussed a conceptual amendment to add language to the resolve clause on page 2, line 17, after energy resources, and reads to the effect that so long as there is no other economic competition for the water source. And so Representative Tuck has an amendment. Representative Tuck, would you like to move that amendment?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I move amendment number one.
Object.
Object. For the purposes of discussion, is there any discussion?
No, just object.
Well, real quick, Mr. Chair, thank you very much. What I'm trying to do is make sure this is a resolution that actually gets Congress to act, and it doesn't make any sense to me why water and hydro is not a renewable energy resource. Alaska has plenty of those resources in the state of Alaska. We're not able to take full advantage of some of the tax credits that are available for renewable energies and alternative energies. And I really appreciate the resolution and the resolve saying that urging Congress to make sure that hydroelectric power is classified as renewable and alternative energy. One of the things that we talked about at the Energy Council was how to make this resolution pass and still have protected interest. And so by adding the clause in, as long as there's no other economic competition for the water resource, because we understand that other states have concerns with hydroelectric that we just don't have up here in Alaska. And so how we can make this resolution benefit Alaska, at the same time get something passed through Congress that will, you know, protect everybody's interests. So all I'm trying to do, Mr. Chair, is to improve the resolution with the likelihood of some bill being passed to get hydroelectric renewable energy for all of America, and especially for Alaska.
Thank you. Is there further discussion? Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam, Mr. Chairman. This amendment would make the language in this resolution compatible with the definition that the U.S. Senate Energy Committee is going to be considering and hopefully also passing. And so I think it's important that we add this definition in there so that they can see that we're on the same page. And I just think it would make it easier for our congressional delegation back east if we just added this one sentence to sort of bring out the details a little more to the same as what they're going to have.
Thank you. Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Appreciate that. I would have to say I don't know if we need to carve out a special exception right now. We don't know if that resolution is going to pass. I think the resolution makes a clear statement without that. I am loath to do it, so I do maintain my objection.
Thank you, Representative Sadler. Representative Pruitt.
Thank you, Chair. One of my concerns is that we could be redundant in this. Part of what takes place whenever a hydroelectric or a hydro project is approved, is that FERC licensing requires that basically what we're saying in here is that it takes place. It has to go through the environmental impact statement. Has to have the water rights, guarantee that it's not going to take away from any other economical uses of the water resource, whether it's a lake or stream, any of that. So, in essence, a hydro project to get a final approval, at no time can it ever degrade a fishery or any other potential economic use of the water. So I think my concern is we want to make sure that we keep it clean, and I'm worried that we kind of make a little bit of redundancy by actually adding the wording that we have in here. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Further discussion?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think a lot of this stuff is redundant to what the bill is being introduced right now. I'm just trying to emphasize the bill and trying to make it to where we have something that will hopefully be accepted, more accepted. That's all I'm trying to do. I'm not trying to hold back the resolution. I totally agree with the resolution. I'm just trying to enhance the resolution, make it more attractive for other states to want to get on board with.
Representative Lynn.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. It seems to me that there's potential for making this a better bill. I don't see much potential for harm. And I would support the amendment.
Further discussion? Seeing none, Representative Seiler, do you maintain your objection?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. Hearing the objection, will the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Peterson?
Yes.
Representative Tuck?
Yes.
Representative Lynn?
Yes.
Representative Olson is not here. Representative Sadler?
No.
Representative Foster?
No.
Representative Pruitt?
No.
I have 3A and
3A. What was that?
Hold it.
3-3?
Hold it. Okay.
You knew it fails.
It fails.
Oh. With that, the amendment fails. Are there any other amendments? Okay, hearing none. With no other amendments, the chair will accept a motion to move House Joint Resolution 23 from committee with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal note.
Mr. Chair, I move House Joint Resolution 23, version M, with amendments and fiscal note and individual recommendations.
Thank you. Are there any objections? Seeing none, House Joint Resolution 23 is moved from committee with individual recommendations accompanying fiscal note. Thank you. Now, presentation on natural gas potential in the Nenana River, the Susitna River, Copper River Valley basins, and the Bering Sea region. My intention today was to shed some light on some potential gas fields outside the North Slope and Cook Inlet. Joining us to help with that is Bob Swenson. Bob is the director of the Alaska Division of Geological and Geophysical Surveys. Welcome, Mr. Swenson. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Bob Swenson. I'm the director and state geologist of the Division of Geological and Geophysical Surveys within DNR. I appreciate this opportunity to talk to the committee today on sedimentary basins in Alaska. I know we get a lot of press and a lot of information on the two basins that have a lot of activity, including the Cook Inlet and the North Slope basins. Not a lot of information has been put out in the public realm on the other basins around the state, and that's what my presentation will be today. What you see on the screen in front of you is a typical outcrop of tertiary stratigraphy, and I'll be talking and explaining a lot of these geologic terms to you here over the next 15 minutes. But what you see here are very thick sandstones. This is the type of rock that you find natural gas in. Interbedded within those sandstones are coal layers. This is actually an outcrop on the Kenai Peninsula. This is a very typical type rock package that you find in these tertiary basins in throughout Alaska, and I'll talk to these different basins one at a time. The next slide here just shows the digital elevation model of Alaska, shows the complexities, the mountain ranges and the intervening valleys. Also has, as the light blue dots, shows the population centers of villages and towns across the state and the wide distribution of those villages. One of the issues, of course, is the geology that underlies the ground surface here. On the north slope, that's what we call a Mesozoic or much older basin. That's where all the oil and gas is generated and is being produced on the north slope right now. And in the southern part of the state, what we call the Mesozoic section generates oil and migrates into reservoirs, and that's what's produced. However, about 65 million years ago in geologic terms, the state went through a relatively large transition in what type of depositional style. It was in pretty much the configuration that it is in right now. But we went through a phase of uplift and erosion, and what the result of that was is a whole series of what we call tertiary basins. And this is a distribution of those tertiary basins around the state. That's rock that was deposited during the tertiary time. I'll talk a bit more about how the rock was deposited into it and also the oil and gas potential associated with these basins. But that's really the focus of today's talk, not the older basins that, such as the North Slope or the deeper part of the Cook Inlet. But first, I guess I'd like to just run through a bit of geology. It's important that we have a basic understanding of how these basins were formed, because that's an important part of whether or not we see oil or gas potential within these basins. And the one issue for sure is that the subduction along the Aleutian Trench in the southern part of the basin really drives the entire geologic system. You can see on this slide here the oceanic crust subducting beneath a continental crust. We're creating new crust at this oceanic spreading ridge, and it moves away from that spreading ridge, and each one of the ocean basins has these spreading ridges. And then when it encounters a continent, it subducts beneath that continent because it has much higher density. As it subducts down into the mantle, what happens is the plate will actually lose rigidity, quits having earthquakes at about 200 kilometers. And it also dewaters and creates partial melting in the mantle just above it at about 200 kilometers, and that molten rock is very buoyant and moves to the surface, and that's why we see the volcanoes associated with these subduction zones. And you'll see in the next slide how that exactly is the case within in Alaska. One of the issues of that subducting plate, if it's a nice smooth plate as is indicated here, there's not a lot that goes on other than the volcanic activity and some deformation in interior in the continent. However, if you have island arcs or if you have small microcontinents or other things that cannot go down the subduction zone, it can cause a tremendous amount of deformation in the crust of the continent. And that's one of the big aspects of Alaska and how it created these internal basins. This next slide here shows, a digital elevation model, including the bathymetry in the ocean. You can see that Alaska is very complex, both topographically and geologically. And again, the reason for that is the fact that we are subducting Pacific plate underneath the Alaskan continental margin. Associated with that subduction, of course, the red triangles that you see there are related to all the active volcanoes that you saw in that earlier slide. The darker blue X's that you see are earthquakes. And that's earthquakes that are about 200 kilometers in depth. So you can see right where the plate is going underneath the slab and where the volcanoes overlie that. And so that matches the cross-section that I had shown you before. Associated with that, and specifically in Alaska, because we're looking at the end of the subduction zone into what we call a strike-slip system, where the plate is actually moving parallel to the margin of the continent, that's very similar to the San Andreas Fault in California. You end up with a series of crustal scale faults, very, very large faults. The most popular one that everybody knows about is the Denali Fault. That's the central black line that you see there. However, you can see that each one of those pieces of crust through time over the last probably 200 million years, these pieces of crust have slid along these huge strike-slip systems and created the basins that we then deposit some of the erosive materials off the mountain ranges, and those are the tertiary basins that we're talking about. Another event that happened here in the latest part of the tertiary, and this is the southern part of the southern margin of Alaska, again, see the Pacific Plate, was the docking of a major terrain, and that's the Yakutat Block. You can see it outlined in the southern part there, just on the southern shore of Alaska, outlined by this yellow polygon. And that plate slid along the strike slip system along the west coast of North America, and when it collided in the latest part of the tertiary section age, it caused a tremendous amount of deformation in interior Alaska. In fact, the large-scale structures, and I'll show you one of those, in the Cook Inlet are related to this docking event when that microcontinent essentially accreted onto South Alaska. I'm about done with the geology lesson here.
question, Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Quick question. So you're saying this whole Yakutat plate all moved north, or was it a strike slip? What's the motions of axis on this?
Certainly. That's a good question through the chair, Representative Sadler. The Yakutat block actually was sliding along. You can see in the lower right corner, you can see the arrows associated with the strike slip fault. And when it encountered southern Alaska and the Aleutian Trench, it essentially tried to be subducted down the subduction zone. It is continental crust, and so it can't actually, it's too buoyant to go down the subduction zone. And so that's when you accrete those type of blocks onto the continent in the south. And so it slid along until it hit the Aleutian Trench. Once that happened, it caused all the deformation in the interior Alaska. Okay, one of the issues associated with all of this deformation, this is a DEM of the southern part of Alaska. You can see Anchorage and Valdez and Taft's Line running down through the middle. The Denali Fault to the north and the Castle Mountain Fault, which are both currently active faults in this state, and have a lot of geohazards associated with that active motion. But you see a lot of mountain building. In fact, Mount McKinley, the largest mountain in North America, is a result of this strike slip motion. It's uplifted along that an arcuate bend in the Denali Fault and creates a tremendous amount of topography. Well, that topography through time erodes. And one of the other features along any one of these fault systems are depressions, the low parts. So all the material that's being eroded off those mountains then is deposited into these depressions, and these depressions are things like Susitna Basin and Copper River Basin. And so this is the reason that these basins are located across the state, and they all have very, very different histories. They all have very different configurations because they're associated with these high deformation rates. So what fills these depressions? The vast majority of the stratigraphy that we see, the rock that we see in these basins, is all non-marine. You can see the block diagram on the upper right where the sediment is being eroded off the highlands and into the lowlands, and you have a meandering stream in this sense, and the picture to the right shows a meandering sequence and the accretion of all of the sediment into this basin. If the basin is subsiding, if it continues to subside, that stratigraphy can get significantly thick. The photo that you see on the left is a photo, again, in the Cook Inlet region with the same type of stratigraphy. The coals would be deposited in the interim areas between the rivers. That's the organic material that is laid down and then buried by a subsequent river passages across that. And then the sandstones associated with those river systems. And as these basins continue to depress, that sediment can become incredibly thick. And in fact, in the Cook Inlet region, that gets up to 25,000 feet thick, almost 5 miles thick of this type of stratigraphy. The cross-section that you see here are a number of wells, and there's a map on the lower right-hand corner there. This is the Beluga River gas field, and this is the series of wells along the crest of that, and it shows when you drill into these structures what you encounter in the wellbore. The black lines that you see on there are all the coals that you saw in the outcrop. The yellow is all sand bodies that were laid down by these meandering and anastomosing rivers. The interim parts of that, of course, are the fine-grained sequences. Like if you fly over the Susitna Basin right now, you see areas where the rivers are. That's where the coarse material and sand is being deposited. And in between that, you have the overbank. During flood sequence, you get fine-grained sequences, and that's what creates the seals that trap the gas if you're in a trapping configuration. But as you can see, the geometries of all these things can be very, very complicated. But the good note here is the amount of sand that you have in the system to create reservoir. And then finally, after much deposition, much subsidence, what happens in the later phases in most of these basins is that you end up with a series, and this is all related to the collision of that Yakutat block, the once flat-lying stratigraphy that was associated with this, these depositional events, is then folded. This is a seismic line over the southern part of the Granite Point structure as well as the South Cook Inlet structure. The scale on the left is actually in two-way time, but about halfway down through this section represents about 6,000 feet of stratigraphy. You can see the thickness here is tremendous, and it's continuous sand, siltstones, and coals all the way down through that. One of the other key...
Could you explicate the color coding of this? Just, you know, what color indicates what?
The lines that are interpreted in there, yeah. That's the top of the Beluga formation. We have four major formations in the tertiary section in the Cook Inlet. The top is the top of the Beluga formation. The stuff that's near the surface is Sterling, and the blue line is the Tionic formation. And those are just from geologic formations in the subsurface. Another key aspect of this is all of these tertiary basins, oftentimes when we see petroleum systems are there because of the temperatures the rocks reach. In other words, you lay down a significant amount of organic carbon, and that might be in the form of marine animals, or it might be in the form of terrestrial plants, like in this sequence where you get the coals and leaves and sticks and things that come into these rivers. One of the ways to generate hydrocarbons is to get that rock deep enough to where it actually gets hot enough to generate hydrocarbons, either oil or gas. Many of these tertiary basins, because they were deposited so fast, do not get to the correct temperature necessary to actually generate the oil and gas that we see, for example, in the North Slope or even in the Cook Inlet. And I say in the Cook Inlet only with the oil, because the oil is actually migrating out of the deeper parts of the section, which was cooked to, if you will, cooked to the right temperature to create the hydrocarbon and expel it and migrate it up into these structures. The other part of this is called a biogenic system. That's just pure natural gas, and that is what the Cook Inlet is. Out of the 8 trillion cubic feet of gas that we see as reserves in the Cook Inlet, 90-some percent of that is all biogenic. It was actually created in a near-surface scenario by the bacteria and that were actually eating on the organic material as it was being deposited. As it continues to be buried, then that is actually dissolved in the water or adsorbed onto the coal. And so the gas just sits in place as it continues to be buried. When you have a large structural event like this where you get folding and uplifting, what happens is you reduce the pressure on that, on both of the in-situ waters that are in the pore spaces as well as the coals in with the inner beds. And what that happens is that you actually release that gas out of solution and desorb it out of the coals. And once that happens, then it has the chance to migrate into the structures. A structure like this on the right here, that very similar to what the Beluga River gas field where the Kenai gas field looks like, you can accumulate up to 2 trillion cubic feet of natural gas that was generated biogenically. And that's the good news for the interior basins, because very, very few of them have a marine source rock or have the enough temperature to actually generate thermogenic-type hydrocarbons.
Takes me back to my geology classes. I'm sorry, it's fascinating. But so just make sure, so the accumulation material that creates the sandstone, that's just the erosion off the mountains and the deposition in the lower areas, repeat for centuries.
Representative Sadler, through the chair, that is correct. In fact, this diagram here can speak to that. Currently, there are a number of different depositional centers in the state where we're actually accreting on additional material. All of that material is being generated in the mountain ranges. So each one of the streams, each piece of rock that breaks off is carried down along these streams, specifically in flood events, out into these basins. If the basin is actually subsiding, it's making accommodation space to accumulate that stratigraphy. If it's not subsiding or uplifting, it'll actually bypass that, and we'll see it, and it actually makes it all the way out into a marine setting, out into the deltas in a marine setting.
That question is, and so that was leading to the question of how deep does it have to be to cook to get the pressure temperature right? How deep does it have to be, Alan?
Representative Sato, through the chair, it's a very good question. It depends very much on the geothermal gradient. It depends on how hot it gets with depth. A normal geothermal gradient in the state is about 25 degrees per kilometer. Okay, so it gets it at about 10,000 feet, you'd expect to see about, say, 200 degrees Fahrenheit. And so to get down into the region where you're generating enough heat or within the stratigraphy in these interior basins, you have to get down into the 18 to 20,000 foot range to generate enough heat to generate hydrocarbons. The other thing, point on this slide that's important to note is these, if you look closely, all the exploration wells in the state are located in the small black dots. And obviously it's very much concentrated in the North Slope. And that's in the older part of the section, in the oil generating part of the section, and in the Cook Inlet. But there are a number of wells around the state that did test and provide us information on the various basins around the state. And that's where I'm going to go to next, is individual basins, and talk about the exploration history and what their potential is. Another aspect here is that the USGS has taken a lot of the data from around the state and done a resource assessment. This is the gas resources, the technically recoverable estimates of gas resources around the state. I won't go through this in great detail, but as you will see on this, just if you focus in on Central Alaska there, for natural gas, technically recoverable, there is no economic filter on this. The range is from 0.5 TCF or 500 BCF to 7.3 TCF, so the wide range of possibilities of what you might find in these basins, and that includes all the basins in interior Alaska. Their mean, in other words, the mean of their distribution is right at 2.3 TCF. And each one of the basins have had this analysis done, and the size of that range really depends on how much information that we have available to us to do that analysis. So if we start looking at some of the basins, again, we talked about these basins being associated with these large crustal strike slip faults, and you can see those as the long black lines that are on there. Those are the big faults that transgress Central Alaska. The Yukon Basin to the north, the Nanana Basin just south of Fairbanks, the Susitna Basin just north of Cook Inlet region and near Talkeetna, and the Copper River Basin. And the first basin I'll be talking to is the Nanana Basin. This is a map on the base of that tertiary section, and so it's essentially an inverted topographic map, and it tells you the thickness of that basin, the geometries of the basin. It's a very odd-shaped basin, but that's the case with most of these basins that are associated with these large crustal fault features. The contour interval there is about 2,000 feet, and you can see that there are two sub-basins that have been the exploration highlight of each of the work that's been gone on in this region over the last 20 years. The red line that you see there is a cross section. The next slide will show you a series of well logs associated with those wells. It gives you an idea of what the stratigraphy is in the basin. You can see on the north near the Alaska Range on the left side of the upper cross section there, we see that orange with the small circles in it. That's the Nanana gravels. That is the rock that was eroded off the Alaska Range when it first came up. That's when Mount McKinley first started building. You have a huge, thick pile of very coarse material that came off of the mountain range. Out in the basin proper, however, what we see are a whole series of lacustrine deposits, lacustrine being associated with lakes, as well as delta and sandstones associated with these river systems. The cross-section you see on the south from northwest to southeast gives you an idea of what that stratigraphic package within that looks like. The central part of it, the post-extensional part of that, is the part where I showed in one of those earlier slides where we had a river system transgressing across the Nanana Basin as it subsided and continued to gather stratigraphy. An example of what we'd expect to see in the subsurface. This is in the Yucibelli group in the outcrop along the south part of the region that's now been uplifted. Here, of course, are these very, very thick coals associated with organic material being deposited within the Nanada Basin early on in its history. And intervening between that are very thick, coarse sandstones. This is exactly what you want to see from the exploration standpoint. The coals are what are going to be generating the gas. The sands are what are going to be actually reservoiring that gas. In the Nanada Basin statistics, it's a tertiary non-marine basin. We've talked about that significantly. Important point is that it's up to 18,000 feet thick in the deepest parts of it. The thickness of a basin is really important from the standpoint of its generative capacity, how much gas you can actually generate. This is actually would get you down into the temperatures in the lower parts of the section that you might actually see some oil generation if you had the correct type of source rock. It's time equivalent to the Cook Inlet group. The oil potential is fairly low. All the oil that you see in the Cook Inlet is actually generated in the stratigraphy that's under the basin, the Mesozoic stratigraphy, not within the tertiary section. But there are some lacustrine deposits in the Nanada Basin that could possibly generate oil, but the potential is low. There's very relatively little seismic data across the basin, about 350 miles of two-dimensional seismic data in the central part of the basin that was shot in the 80s. The reserve potential outcomes are wide and they're poorly constrained. We do not have a lot of information to constrain what possible resource plays might be there. There were two wells drilled early on, Unical and Arco Totec Hills. However, the entire, as you saw in that cross-section, the entire part of the basin was not penetrated. They were in the much shallower part of the basin.
Catch my breath for a minute every once in a while, but what is a basement high? Kind of sounds like a contradiction.
Oxymoron.
Yeah. Like Representative Sadler through the chair, that's a very good question. A basement high, and that there'll be another cross-section I can actually come up and visually show you what that is. What it means is that the basement is what the tertiary basin sits on. We call that basement. Geologists call that basement of the basin. And a basement high means that it is elevated up by a fault, and so all the stratigraphy has been either draped around it or deposited up against it, and so it's just a high point in the what we call the basement of the basin. Thanks for that clarification. One of the key aspects of the Nanana Basin, this is the most recent activity that we've seen recently, and that is that along the southern margin of the basin we see a lot of deformation. So all that stratigraphic package with the coals and the sandstones has been deformed into these large folds that you saw in that seismic section that I showed you earlier in the Cook Inlet. And that truly is the exploration target right now in the Nanana Basin, is understanding that. That also allows the uplift of the stratigraphy to release the gas that's generated in those coals. And so that's something you must see in these basins to be able to come up with an exploration play to drill. Okay, now I'm going to just move up to the Yukon Flats Basin. I only have one slide for this. It's a relatively large basin and it's a relatively deep basin, and there actually is a fair amount of exploration going on currently. It's up to about 23,000 feet thick. It's associated with what we call the Tintina Fault to the north, and it has the same tertiary stratigraphy with all the coals and sandstones associated with it. There are some lacustrine, highly organic material in some of the rock, and so there is a fair amount of potential that the industry currently is looking at. Okay, now we'll move down into what we call the Rail Belt region, and specifically go to the Susitna Basin and then move over to the Copper River Basin. You see the Susitna Basin is right under the word Rail Belt, and the Copper River is the yellow stratigraphy. And this is a geologic map that shows what's exposed at the surface. The darker colors are all the older rock, the yellow or the tertiary rock. The Susitna Basin is an interesting basin. It again has two sub-basins, and you can see there's a between the two lighter gray polygons, there's an uplifted area, so that would be associated similar to a basement high. There's been relatively little exploration effort gone on in this basin, and this region is actually, because of its proximity to the Cook Inlet area, as well as the deformation and the stratigraphy that we see in the basin, it's the focus of a two-year study that we will begin this summer on gathering geologic information around the entire basin, as well as looking at the subsurface information to provide the resource potential for the state. The slide you see on the right is some of the data that we use for these analyses. That's the topography or the digital elevation model with the gravity survey draped over the top. And the gravity survey just tells us where the deepest, much less dense stratigraphy within the basin lies. And you can see those two sub-basins set up in that gravity information. The stratigraphy there, again, is similar to the Cook Inlet. It's separated on its southern margin by a large-scale, currently active fault, and that's the Castle Mountain Fault. There's up to 15,000 feet of tertiary section within that basin, within the larger sub-basin. And it overlies Mesozoic metamorphic complex and tertiary volcanics, and that just points to its oil generative capabilities. It's very limited. This basin lacks the Paleocene or early Oligocene, so that's the very much oldest part of the section that's down into the Hemlock Formation. That's where we produce all the oil out of in the Cook Inlet. It's not in existence here. This was not a depositional center during that time. There's been two wells up in the basin proper. They were drilled on 1960s vintage seismic, and they have some seismic and gravity information. It is gas-prone. And we don't identify or haven't identified to date any viable oil source rocks. It's currently under an exploration license by the Cook Inlet Energy, and it is going to be the focus of detailed mapping effort by DGGS this summer. Okay, now we're going to move to the Copper River Basin. The Copper River Basin is, again, very similar to the Cook Inlet tertiary section. And the interesting thing about the Copper River Basin is it's much broader but did not get to the depths that the rest of the section was. It's only about 3,000 feet of tertiary stratigraphy there versus the 18 to 20,000 feet in these other basins. There is Mesozoic, immature Mesozoic rock, and that's the older rock that actually generates the oil in the Cook Inlet. And it is on the western portion of the basin and plunges beneath the tertiary basin in that area. But the rest of the basin is surrounded by metamorphic and volcanic rocks. There is some potential in the Mesozoic marine section, and there has been drilling to try to capture that potential. There were 11 wells, and they were drilled on 1970 vintage seismic data and limited gravity and magnetic data. It, again, is a gas-prone basin. There is some oil source in the Mesozoic section, but it has been immature where it's been encountered, and that means it has not gotten to the temperature necessary to generate oil. The recent exploration wells that have been drilled in that area, there has been no commercial discovery announced. Okay, now I'd like to move offshore to the Bering Shelf basins. It's a very interesting area. There are very large basins in this area. They are, again, and you can see here, it's called wrench tectonics. That's the same thing, big strike-slip systems that create these large sags, if you will, that create accommodation space for stratigraphy or sand and coal and shale when it's deposited in the area. And they are primarily gas plays, and that's an important point to point out here. I'll first talk to the Norton Basin. I won't go specifically to the Hope Basin, and I have statistics on the Navarin Basin. The Navarin Basin is very interesting geologically, and I will not be talking about the North Aleutian or the St. George. One of the things that we'll be looking at are a series of stratigraphic columns showing that we have non-marine or coals and terrestrial or continental type deposits out in the Bering Sea. At first blush, that's a little bit difficult to understand. You'd imagine that since they're in a marine environment that you would not be able to deposit coals and other type non-marine sequences. So what I've got here is a series of slides that show you the Bering land bridge through over the last 20,000 years. It's a very intriguing series of slides, and I'll just walk through them and give you the dates here. So this is today. This is what the current look is today. At 9,000 years ago, that's what it looks like.
Representative Sadler?
The colors indicate what again? So just what's the key or the legend?
Representative Sadler through the chair. The blue is the coastline. That's the marine waters. And then the other colors on the shore just is the different elevations. And so the higher elevations are the darker browns. The lower elevations go down to green. And so it just gives you the elevation of the topography.
Okay. And the white, it looks almost photographic. Is the White Snack Glacial at there? Anything is?
the white is not glacial, but what you're going to be seeing here is actually a recession or a pullback of the marine waters associated with continental glacial ice sheets. All the water that makes up the continental glacial ice sheets actually lowers the sea level, and you'll see that over this 20,000-year animation. And so at 9,000 years ago, you can see where the shoreline was. At 10,000 years ago, the shoreline was here. At 11,000 years ago, the shoreline was here. And at 12,000 here, 14,000, and 20,000 years. And so when you had the full continental ice sheets 20,000 years ago during what we call the Wisconsin Age, the Bering Land Bridge was completely exposed. And that doesn't mean that all the tertiary material that were deposited in these basins were deposited during this time. However, this is a phenomena that's happened many, many times through geologic time. And that's why we see coals and non-marine stratigraphy in these basins out in the Bering Shelf. Okay, this map here shows the Norton and Hope basins in the offshore. It's on the Seward Peninsula, and I think Nome is shown there, as well as Kotzebue to the north. Both the Hope Basin and the Norton basins are again these tertiary basins that were created along, and in this case, the Norton Basin along the Caltag Fault. You can see in the lower right corner of this map. If you take a look at a structure map at a base, again, at the base of that tertiary unconformity, you can see that the Norton Basin is a very complicated basin. Lots of big faults, lots of thicks, where a significant amount of stratigraphy has been deposited. The next slide that you'll see is a cross-section from A to A prime, and a cross-section is just taking a slice out of the basin and putting it on the screen. So that's what it would look like, where the upper parts of the lines represent the formations that were deposited within these fault grabens. The Yukon Horst would be one of these basement uplifts that we were talking about. The key point of this cross-section is, from an explorationist standpoint, what this does is sets up a tremendous number of exploration plays, trapping configurations for the accumulation of either natural gas or oil if it were generated in this basin. And that's why we saw a lot of exploration in the basin, is because of the stratigraphy and what you just saw. There have been two cost wells that were drilled by ARCO in 1980 and 82. The OCS sailed number 57 in March of 1983. There were 59 tracks sold for $325 million. There were six exploration wells in the mid-80s, and all of these exploration wells showed some indication of natural gas, and one or two had actual weak oil shows. And it's important to note here what a geologist mean when they say shows. Shows, what that means is, as you're drilling in any one of these exploration wells, all the samples that come up from the drill bit are run over a shaker, washed, and cleaned, and a geologist takes a look at them. A geologist will look at it for what type of rock it is. He'll mark it down exactly on what depth was being drilled, and he's putting together what we call a mud log. And you end up with a stratigraphic column that's represented by the drill bit going down. One of the things that you do during that is, as the mud is carrying these cuttings up from the drilling bit, you have a gas sniffer at where it comes out of the ground. And if there is any gas that's in within the sequence, that gas sniffer will actually take it, and you'll see what type of gas, whether it's methane or a higher linked hydrocarbon, and it'll plot it up on a chart. And so you'll see when you see the gas shows, and that's what a gas show is about. The oil shows are actually determined by taking a look at the samples and looking at them under black light, and hydrocarbons will actually fluoresce under black light, and so an oil show will be that. It doesn't mean that there's an accumulation there. It just means that there was, at one time, at least some indication of hydrocarbons. And so that's what shows mean. You can see on the map on the lower right the distribution of wells in amongst the different structures. So the geologic summary of the Norton Basin, again, another tertiary extensional basin associated with the Caltag Fault. It has up to 23,000 feet of tertiary stratigraphy, and it overlies Paleozoic and Mesozoic metamorphosed rocks. So in other words, there is no hydrocarbon potential in metamorphosed rocks. That means they've been cooked too hot. There are two sub-basins separated by a narrow horse system. the mid-tertiary west subbasin playfield is really what the MMS in their reports look at as being the most highly potential within these basins, has the best reservoir quality within these sequences. I won't go through all the different aspects of the basin with age and reservoirs and traps, but the last slide or the last bullet there is really probably the most important, and that is the resource assessment that was done by the MMS. And they look at possibly up to 1.6 trillion cubic feet of gas within this basin. And I'll just have one other final basin, the Navarin Basin, which is off to the southwest. This is the furthest out on the Bering Shelf. It's an incredibly interesting basin. It's the largest and most remote of all the basins. It's 32,000 square miles in aerial size, and again, related to these wrench faults. It's up to 36,000 feet thick. So there's 36,000 feet of non-marine stratigraphy, non-marine and marine stratigraphy deposited within that basin. There's one cost well and eight exploration wells. They did see gas shows as well as limited oil prone source rocks in the Eocene and Paleocene. Seven marine reservoir quality intervals in the tertiary section, so that's very good for exploration potential. Traced to minor gas and oil shows in five of the wells. There is not a federal scale or lease sale scheduled in the area. It certainly will depend on interest and what happens in the OCS. The MMS calculated about 500 million barrels, and this is the mean technically recoverable estimate, 500 million barrels of oil and 6 TCF of gas in the Navarin Basin. Okay, and this is my final slide. All the information that I've been describing here, we are putting together a Alaska Energy Data Inventory. We've done a lot of work around the state. We're continuing to do a lot of work around the state to get better understanding of each one of these areas. And the way we're distributing that information is we put together a website with the Alaska Energy Authority. And all this information will be available here as well as our website. And it'll include all the different basins and all the stratigraphy and all the geologic information associated with that, as well as coal and other geologically sourced energy sources. And with that, I will answer any questions.
I certainly appreciate that, Mr. Swenson. I do have two quick questions. First one, going back, you had mentioned that you were not going to talk about the North Aleutian, mm-hmm. and I'm just referring back to this slide here that showed the potential in the different areas around the state. And I noticed here it says the North Aleutian Basin, the average of 6.8 TCF, and so that looked like it had more than the other areas, not including the North Slope there. And I was just curious why, is it because economically, logistically, it doesn't make sense there, or I was just curious?
Mr. Chairman, no, thank you for that. Actually, I didn't include it specifically because the request of what basins we wanted to cover. We have a full presentation on the North Aleutian Basin, the Bristol Bay Basin. In fact, there's been state onshore lease sales there. We've done a lot of work. The North Aleutian Basin has tremendous potential. Sure. And unfortunately, I wished I would have actually thrown those in. There's a number of seismic lines and work that was done by Mr. Paul Decker, who's the manager for Resource Eval in oil and gas. It's a very interesting area. It has very high potential. It is, again, partially one of the non-marine basins, but has a huge, thick sequence of tertiary stratigraphy that has a relatively high potential.
Oh, thank you. And then the other question regarding the slide that you have up here, the Navarin, just looking at that, it looks to me like it might be more in Russian territory than U.S. there. I'm just curious how you had mentioned that we could potentially explore that. Could you comment on that?
Yeah, and part of the basin is, as I understand, in Russian territory, but it's a very, very huge basin, and the basin, the part that's in the American waters is where ARCO focused their exploration efforts.
Okay. Thank you. Are there any other questions of the committee? Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And on the previous slide that we were referring to, we were talking about the Norton basins, and the Central Alaska Basin as you're using as an example, you use the term unfiltered gas. Does that mean that gas that's there doesn't have to be filtered, or that's just gas that potential all of the gases that will end up being filtered?
I probably missed, excuse me, Representative Tuck through the chair. I probably misspoke. I didn't mean to say unfiltered. I think probably what I was referring to there was that it was a pure methane gas. So it was a what we call C1, just a single molecule. But it's not like the gas that you see in a thermogenic system where you have lots of liquids associated with it and you wouldn't have to process that gas. The methane gas is pure, just like out of the Cook Inlet, and does not have to be processed when it gets to the surface.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Representative Sadler?
Thank you. Bob, I'm going to ask you a real general question that might not be fair to ask, but if you had to rank these different basins by their prospectivity for exploration, is it fair to ask that kind of question? Or depends on a lot of factors, I'm sure, but what's a gross ranking?
Yeah, Representative Sadler through the chair. That's a good question. It right at the moment it's relatively difficult to do that, Representative Sadler. It's and it has to do with the lack of information, but you can make some general statements about that. One is the thickness. For example, in the Copper River Basin, where we only have 3,000 feet, the chance of there being accumulations of gas in that area associated with the tertiary section would be very limited. The thickness of the section that you have is very, very important. So if you get one of these basins that's up to 20,000 feet thick, you have that much more generative capacity within the basin. The other thing that's incredibly important is, again, that deformation. It's one thing to deposit it and have the coals there. It's another thing that you have to release that gas from where it's adsorbed or in solution in the water. And so the uplifting, the deformation, and the folding, uplifting that releases the pressure. So that's another key criteria. The Nanana Basin, the Yukon Basin, the Susitna Basin are all, of course, in that realm, and that's why we're seeing the exploration activity. The challenge, of course, is the distance to infrastructure and the size of the prize. You would not expect to find a 12 trillion cubic foot field in one of these basins. It's going to be much smaller accumulations, and so that's why we don't see a lot of industry activity in these areas. It's very, very expensive to explore, to shoot seismic, to drill wells, and the size of the potential accumulations are usually relatively small in comparison.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So when we're talking about these potential natural gas wells, are these traditional gas wells? Are these coal bed methane? Are they shale gas? Are there some of each?
Yeah. Representative Peterson through the chair. That's another very good question. Thanks. I didn't mention the unconventional potential in these basins, and that's a very good point. I think one of the issues here is that, as you saw in nearly all the slides that I had here, that we do see a lot of coal in these basins, and all of these areas are going to have some potential for coal bed methane. The issue with coal bed methane here is also related to the maturity of the coal. To have a viable coal bed methane play, the coal actually has to have been buried deep enough to get to what we call a subbituminous level. And if it's not been buried very deep and not got very hot, it's called lignite. Mm-hmm. And the way that you move the gas out of these coals is along cleats. There is no permeability or pathways to move the gases, so you need this cleating. And that is really related, again, to the structuring. If you can take the coals that were buried relatively deep, and because of the structuring along the basin edge, bring them closer to the surface, that makes it a much more viable coal bed methane play. But each one of these areas that has thick coals will have that coal bed methane potential. The shale gas is a bit different story because we don't generate the gas within a classic marine shale. Marine shales are what you're seeing being delineated in the lower 48. We certainly have that on the North Slope in the marine section on the North Slope. But we would not expect to see that in interior basins.
Thank you.
Thank you. Are there further questions of the committee? Representative Pruitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess the one that I'm most interested in actually is the one that you have there. It's in the basin. It's mm-hmm. closest to the Anchorage area, the Anchorage Bowl, the South Central. And I see we've already put a couple wells in. And I apologize if I speak outside of not having a geological degree. This is very fascinating, but I don't get all of it. Give me a little bit of time. What I want to make sure, what's the potential in this Susitna Basin? I see that there, if I understand correctly we do have, it is a deeper tertiary section, which means there's a higher possibility of having the hydrocarbons there. does look like that there is gas possibilities, just not the oil possibilities, and people are currently exploring. What is the potential there for providing potential future gas opportunities for South Central? And what's the feasibility of getting it to market, I guess, would be the other portion of it.
Representative Pruitt, through the chair, excuse me. that is, you've hit right on the head exactly why we are going out there this summer and continuing our gathering of geologic information. You see the two depot centers, the two thick parts of the basin. Also associated on this basin is a fair amount of deformation along the Castle Mountain Fault. And so, and plus we have the same tertiary stratigraphy that we see in the Cook Inlet. The issue of the amount of exploration that has gone on in the past in comparison to the Cook Inlet, there's very little if zero chance to find oil within this basin. And oil was a big driver for exploration in the Cook Inlet, and that's how we found all the gas in the Cook Inlet. Does it have the same generative potential of the Cook Inlet? Probably not, but it does have generative potential. And because we see the same coals, the same type of stratigraphy, as well as uplift, as well as the deformation that we need to not only get the gas out of solution, but also trap it in structures is there. It's just that we don't have enough information. The other part of your point there is the proximity to infrastructure. That's a really important part. Because the costs of these exploration efforts are so high, and that the amount or the size of the prospect that you're going has to be relatively large, and your market has to be available immediately, and the market has to be large so you can monetize the discovery and the amount of money you put into it. And so the Susitna Basin is uniquely positioned in that, in all of the basins. It may not have the highest potential of these basins, but it certainly has the highest potential to get to a market quickly, and that makes the exploration a more attractive to industry.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. I've got a question. You had mentioned the distance to infrastructure is one obstacle, and this also is going to be probably a broad general question, but if you can't answer it, that's fine. With regard to those regions that are not close to infrastructure, what's the potential for development from a long-term perspective when you take into account, you know, some of the things that we're hearing in the news? For example, is the EPA going to start clamping down on coal in the future? And if they do that, then maybe utilities start to switch over to cleaner burning fuels, mm-hmm. For example, natural gas. I mean, just kind of almost a philosophical, you know, looking way out in the future on that one. Can you maybe elaborate on that?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, it's a very good question. It's something that we wrestle with all the time. The geology in any one of these areas, if you took one of these basins and plopped it into the middle of the lower 48, you'd have seen a lot of drilling activity going on. I mean, they would have already drilled this up, and they'd have already known what the potential is and all that. The fact that you're in the middle of Alaska really holds off a lot of that type of exploration. Another limiting factor here is the upside potential, if you will. And any time that you spend significant risk capital as an exploration company, you go out and spend $250 million on seismic and wells and all that, you expect to see the chance of finding something very, very large. And that's another problem in these smaller basins, is that the chance of seeing a 3 or 4 trillion cubic foot accumulation is pretty limited. You're going to probably run into much smaller accumulations. Now, that for the rural energy issue, that's a very important thing. The smaller accumulations don't matter. The problem is that the cost of actually exploring for them and finding them is so great in most cases, especially when there are remote situations like this. It makes it very difficult to justify that. And so the more data, the more information that we gather, so we can focus in on a certain given area, that's the important thing. In the long term, the gas isn't going to go anywhere. And as we gather additional information, we'll be able to push some things off to the side and say, this is where you should focus if we are going to make that investment.
Representative Sadler.
Perfect segue. Thank you. I was going to ask a question. This is not a budget subcommittee. You're not asking us for more resources. But how much data do you have enough data to make the What's the source of this data? You heard a lot about vintage 60s and 70s, which by assuming is not so good as you'd like. Mm-hmm. Is this a company exploring for gas? Is it just pure geology? What's the source of your data? I mean, do you have enough?
Yeah, Representative Satter through the chair. No, we certainly don't have enough to totally classify the basins. There's a number of issues there. The different data sources that we have, airborne data is obviously a lot cheaper than on-the-ground seismic, and we do shoot a lot of airborne gravity and airborne geophysics and magnetics and things. We do that for a number of reasons. That's one of the data sets that we use. There is some older seismic data that was shot back in the 60s when we saw such an incredible series of exploration programs around the state. That's when the 60s through the 80s, when we saw the drilling out in the Bering Sea, as well as all the wells that you're seeing in the interior basin. So we do have that limited data available. The other data that we have is ground mapping. In the basin proper, unfortunately, we have very limited. I mean, we've all been out in interior Alaska. There's not a lot of rock outcrop until you get into the mountain ranges. And so that can be a limiting factor. But those are the data sets that we have, the subsurface information and the surface.
What's your prospects for getting more data? I mean,
Representative Satter, through the chair, we are working very hard to get additional data. In fact, we map continuously around the state every year. We have, in fact, I have our annual report there in front of you that outlines all the different regions that we're working and the different projects that we have. And anytime we can get additional information, surface information on these areas, we do that. Some of the data is confidential. The state has it, and we can use it for our interpretation. We just can't publish it.
Thank you. Great.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Representative Pruitt.
One last question, because I know we want to get to the Energy Wise program. I want to just ask real quick about the Navarin Basin.
Navarin.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like that, of the ones we talked about here, has probably one of the greatest potentials. It's obviously offshore. It's a little ways away from the infrastructure that we need. But we've obviously drilled there. Is there potential that in the future, it looks like potentially 6 trillion cubic feet out there, that some of the newer technology that they're coming up with, I know they're building, for instance, off in Australia, they're building an offshore rig that they can actually move instead of no longer having to. I think companies are starting to figure out, hey, with putting infrastructure in one place and not being able to move it could limit us. Is there potential in the future that we could access some of that because of the newer technology or the push that's going on to access these resources into the future?
Right. Representative Pruitt through the chair. Yes, the technology is advancing tremendously across the board, both surface and in the subsurface and drilling technology and what you can and can't do. There's no question that the game is changing, if you will. The problem with an area like the Nana Basin is, number one, its remoteness. It's so far from anything. For all the infrastructure, you have to get it way out there and all that. And that's a limiting factor. The other limiting factor is the costs associated with exploring an area like that. I would hate to guess on what one exploration well would cost out there by the time you would get through all the permitting processes and all of that. But the issue there is if you look globally at all the different areas that because it would take a very large company to be able to do something like that, and they're going to spend, say, let's just pull $500 million out of the air and say that's what it would cost to do an exploration program there. That 6 TCF is an estimate. It's an estimate of how big the entire basin might have, how much gas the entire basin in a number of different accumulations. If you're spending that kind of capital on exploration, you'd expect to actually see fields, single fields, that are 6 TCF in the potential. And so it's that size of the prize to spend that kind of money. So it'd be very, very difficult, I think, to justify exploration in those areas.
Yeah, just follow up.
Yeah, follow up.
So unfortunately for some of these, there's potential they're going to be trapped, even though we know there's potential there just because of remoteness and other limiting factors. Mm-hmm. We might not ever really be able to access them.
Representative Pruitt, through the chair, I've said that in the past, and not specifically on these basins, but on a number of things, and I've been corrected many times. And for example, is shale oil or shale gas? If you'd asked me 15 years ago whether we'd be producing this You're much right. gas and oil out of shale, I'd have said no.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I hesitate to say no. It is going to be challenging. There's no question about it. And it is stranded. It's a stranded resource right now. That's for sure. But things change, and we'll just see. It's a good thing that we have this there.
Great.
Thank you.
We certainly appreciate it, Mr. Swenson. I also wanted to recognize we have Kevin Banks out here with the Division of Oil and Gas in the audience there, and we appreciate you being here. So with that, we do have a presentation on Rural Cap's EnergyWise program. We'll take in at ease here in a moment. Joining us here in Juneau, we have Sarah Scanlon, also Ellen Kazri, Kathy Clements of the Rural Alaska Community Action Program. Online in Selwick, we've got, I believe online, Diana Ramuth, board member of the Nano Regional Corporation. Wanted to welcome all of you. So we're going to take a brief at ease and allow them to get set up here. Go ahead and call the Energy Committee meeting back to order here. And before us, we have Sarah Scanlon. I just wanted to mention that we do have the room until 5 o'clock, so do take your time. And we appreciate your being here and letting us know about this valuable program. So if you'd please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the Energy Committee. We appreciate the invitation to be here to present to you today. I'm not going to actually make the presentation. My colleagues from Rural Cap will, but I'd like to make some opening comments if I could. Thank you. My name is Sarah Scanlon. I'm the Deputy Director at Rural Cap. As you know, we are in over 90 communities around the state. We do a number of programs that are measured and have results that we take great pride in. We do early childhood education, housing programs, construction, weatherization, community development, and supportive housing, and also energy programs. We were happy to hear that this hearing or this discussion with you was scheduled during our annual board meeting in March in Juneau so that we didn't have to take great expense to be here. We were already going to be here, so we appreciate you being able to tie that into our meeting. We also want to thank each of you for the many, many alternatives that you are looking at in reducing the energy burden of Alaskans. This previous presentation, very, very complex, but it appears very important. So, and we know you've got some tough work ahead. I'd like to say that our presentation is going to be one of those that is easy to understand, easy to implement, cheap on the state, or inexpensive on the state. But we also know that we're going into the period of time that our communities are getting ready to order their annual year's supply of fuel and gas, and we know what's happened to gas and oil prices. They're high. We're concerned about elders and senior citizens and others on a fixed income right now and how they are going to meet their household needs in the coming year and probably beyond. So we're happy that we're able to talk to you about this initiative. We're going to talk about how a state investment is going to produce jobs. It's going to create disposable income. You are going to see a huge and quick return on the state's investment, a quick payoff of the state's investment. And we also wanted to talk about how this much-needed program will take some of the burden off other investments that the state has to make. You'll see data. You'll see a proven program that works. And you'll also see a gap that gets filled. We've got the Susitna and other huge renewable energy projects being discussed and considered. We've got the much-needed weatherization and rebate program. But this program that we're going to present to you is one of those that, again, as I mentioned earlier, has a quick ROI for the state and can get implemented very quickly. So, finally, I'm just pleased again that you've allowed us to be here to talk to you about a program that we know works. We know that you will be glad that there's another alternative for reducing the energy burden of Alaska's residents throughout the state, And at this time, I'd like to turn it over to the experts at RuralCAP who know the program, have done it, can and will share the facts and the data about a great investment for the state.
Kathy? You could please identify yourself for the record.
Good afternoon. My name's Kathy Clements, the Community Development Division Director for RuralCAP. And I have with me Ellen Kazeri, our Community Development Manager. Thank you very much for this opportunity to share. We really appreciate this day to be here before you. So with that, we wanted to share energy-wise what it is and our experience with it this last year and what we think it can do for particularly rural Alaskans as they try to battle the high cost of energy they're faced with. So with that, we all know the high costs in rural Alaska, especially for our remote rural residents, are battling up to 30% and 40% of their income, their disposable income, is used towards energy. And with the growing rate of high cost of fuel, we know that this burden is getting higher and higher. And so with that, at the moment, what's available to help those rural residents combat the high cost are energy efficiency programs through weatherization, which the state has put in a significant amount of funding and support over recent years, and also the home rebate program, which, while useful, is hard for rural residents to access because it requires, first of all, energy auditors that are available, and many rural communities don't have those persons on hand. In addition, the requirement to have upfront costs, be able to pay for those improvements, is difficult for many rural residents. And so in addition, we also have renewable energy options that, as we all know, those are very important but yet take time to have a payback and really help those rural Alaskans reduce their energy burden immediately. And so with that, based on the given programs and the needs for rural communities, we helped to design this EnergyWise program, which is really focused on meeting that gap through energy efficiency education and behavior change. This is something that we all know is important, that low-hanging fruit. There's a lot of high potential for energy savings and just learning more about what a person can do. We had this opportunity last year in 2010 to pilot the EnergyWise program through community service block grant funding. And with that, the goals of the program were, first of all, to save on those home energy bills. And this is through not just passive education, but through actually this behavior change that I'm speaking of. And also to provide low-cost home upgrades, not replacing doors and windows like weatherization, but simply those CFL bulbs, some caulking and weather stripping, film on the windows to help insulate windows, as well as water heater blankets, some other low-cost things that are very simple and can be replicated by the home resident. The other plus of EnergyWise is our goal was also to create local jobs, to provide training and employ people locally to help educate and engage in energy efficiency. So some of the benefits, first of all, it's an immediate cost savings. It's something that can be done right away that people can benefit from in the next month or two once they benefit from the services. And then it not only saves the resident, but it also saves the state. For every dollar saved from EnergyWise, for every dollar that the resident saves, $2 is saved by the state in PCE. So I think this is significant for all of us to consider that savings, not just individually, but its implications for the state as well. In addition, the job training and readiness, we have crews that are employed locally for 2 to 4 months, but in addition, we provide them with weatherization certifications, the Weatherization Tech 1, an OSHA certification, and also the energy efficiency education. So with that, they can take those skills and go on and invest in their future and have opportunities for other employment, whether through weatherization or construction or other trades. And, of course, the long-term sustainable impact of this approach in that it's teaching behaviors that can continue to benefit the community, the family, for years to come. I wanted to mention quickly this model of behavior change. It's really important when we think about people and what can be done that we approach it in a way that we know works. With that, it's behavior change theories often tell us that you need to have not just one contact or one meaningful contact, but several in order for people to really take in the message and practice it. And so with that, this project was designed to encounter and have these significant messages and meaningful interactions at several levels. First of all, the message is delivered by local crews. Local crews are hired and trained. People learn about energy efficiency in a way they can understand from their community members that they live in side by side with. Then they're invited to an energy fair. This is a fair that gets the whole community involved. It engages community leaders, community organizations, schools, children of all ages. It's a time where the community comes together and really can learn more as a group. The residents sign up for these home assessments. And then the crews, 2 to 3 crew members per home, will spend 8 hours in the home with the resident going through their energy bills piece by piece and really looking to see where they're spending their energy and making the connection between how they use energy and their bills. And a lot of time that connection isn't quite there. You know, they'll say they'll have the TV on for a certain number of hours a day. They don't really realize how much that really does add up. That's just one example. And so it's kind of a detective work. They'll go outlet by outlet and look through, see what's being used, and help advise on different strategies for savings. In addition, we've provided, and I mentioned these energy-efficient supplies, about $300 worth of supplies are invested in each home. And this gives the resident a way to try out the CFL, see the savings for themselves, and then decide to use the product in the future if that's helping them. Then 3 to 6 months after they have this intensive home visit, there's a follow-up visit where 1 or 2 crew members will come, check on how things are going, answer more questions, provide additional education, and also fill out a survey to find out how much has been saved. And so that's, in a nutshell, our model. It's important to realize that this complements weatherization. This is not weatherization. It's not designed to replace weatherization. It's simply working more with that homeowner, that resident, to go more in depth on the energy efficiency education piece. You know, weatherization focuses on the physical home improvements, and EnergyWise looks at that people part, the behavior change. In our pilot year last year, we targeted communities that were not receiving weatherization or hadn't recently been weatherized or weren't about to be weatherized. As we all know, there's a long list. Despite the tremendous investment the state has made in weatherization, many homes are still needy and not able to access weatherization. So energy, that's where we chose to focus this last year's efforts. But it's important to note that communities that are currently receiving weatherization could also benefit from this, and we could certainly partner as we have plenty of capacity Rural CAP does with weatherization and can certainly work alongside weatherizers to bring that education message to home. So we have here, Ellen can perhaps pass out quickly some packets, and I wanted to mention that this design of EnergyWise and our implementation this last year was done in collaboration with many important organizations in the field, including HFC, AEA, Denali Commission, Department of Energy, regional local organizations, REAP, and ICER and AVEC. Now, ICER has been helping us with the evaluation component of this project, and AVEC has cooperated by providing us with 1 year before and 1 year after electricity bills from those homes that we visited last year. Now, before you in those packets, you'll see support letters that we've collected just recently from NANA, TCC, Central Council of Tlingit Haida Indian Tribes of Alaska, Tlingit Haida Regional Housing Authority, Northwest Arctic Borough, for the Denali Commission, Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, the Department of Energy, National Renewable Energy Lab, who have also been advisors to us, and several rural tribal councils and residents that have received services this last year. And with that, I'll turn it over to Ellen, who will give you more details about exactly how the project was rolled out and some of the results, financial savings, and others.
Thank you. And if you could identify your first and last name.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Ellen Kazari. I'm the Community Development Manager at RealCap. Okay, so one of the great things about being able to present this for you today is that we have done this already in the past. So it's not just a concept. We actually have piloted this, and we had a lot of success in the last year. Last year, we had 160 rural Alaskans that we hired and trained to do this project. They were from the villages where the project was implemented. We were in 2,000 homes over the course of 12 months. We had a 90% retention rate of the crews that we hired. So 90% of those that we hired finished the training and finished the project. And we had education for about 7,500 people in rural Alaska. The big fun part to talk about is that energy and money saved, and we're going to go through that as I talk a little bit about how this project was rolled out. Okay, so we hired crews from the communities. We provided them with training, and then they worked in the homes, as Kathy was describing earlier. We've worked a lot with the housing authorities and the weatherization service providers, and they've given us some good feedback that they would love to be hiring locally. There's a lot of development going on. We're looking ahead at energy development and construction jobs in the future. So we're working to provide these crews with some certifications that will help them be workforce ready for those jobs as they develop. So this is a great first step for them. The training and the certification that we're going to be providing weatherization tech 1 and an OSHA safety training and some first aid. That goes hand in hand with the hands-on experience they'll have working with this project, and that's directly in response to the housing authorities, weatherization, construction people telling us that's what they're looking for in crews they would love to hire locally. Kathy was mentioning those $300 in supplies that we were installing at homes. That table is just what goes into one home. And then the list is, of course, there on the right. What we chose were supplies that are all low-cost, low-tech, easy to install, and that people could replace themselves. So we engage the resident when we go into the home. We show them as we install the supplies. Some of these supplies do wear out over, you know, a few years, so they may have to replace them themselves, but they've been trained on how to do that. And we kept the cost down on the individual supplies so that it is something that even low-income people could choose to replace themselves. Okay, so once we train the crews, we get them ready to do the work in the communities. And as Kathy was saying, they start with a community education event, and that's an energy fair where we get a wide variety of people coming out and hearing the message for the first time. And then, and this is really the part that brings the message home, they do a full-day energy home assessment with the residents. There's a lot of work that's been done all over the country about energy efficiency and conservation, and typically people rely on passive education, public service announcements, billboards, flyers, handouts. And all that does is really raise awareness that this is something you should be doing, but it doesn't teach you how, and it doesn't give you personal incentive as to the why you should be doing it. So what we did was we went into homes and we sat down with residents, we went over their electric and home heating bills, and then we spent the day with them going around to all the different appliances saying, how long do you have this on? And let's test it. So we test it and we sat down and did the math. If you have this on for 8 hours and here's your kilowatt per hour cost, here's what this is costing you a year. And became very personal, and it was like an individual home energy plan that then they could use in the future. And some of the examples we would get, we had a crew leader call us from Selawik the first week he was there, and he's looking at these spreadsheets we created, and he said, well, the math is wrong. The decimal's in the wrong place. We're testing the coffee maker, and it says if he has it on, like many people in rural Alaska do, for 8 hours a day or more, it's costing him $750 a year. That decimal must be in the wrong spot. But it wasn't. And I think that that's the sort of message that really makes an impact on people. They see that and they have a choice. Here's a coffee carafe. It's a bit of a change in behavior, but it's, you know, $40. It's a one-time investment. And here's $750 every year that you could be spending. So we're not telling people they have to change some of their, you know, it's very cultural. Every time I go into home, I get a cup of coffee. I mean, you don't want to tell people you can't do that, but you want to tell people, here's how you can do it cheaply. So we found a number of things like that. There were just really high-cost things and a little bit of a tweak in behavior, and you get some sudden savings. And then, as we've been saying, we installed the supplies, again, engaging the resident, showing them how we did it, and doing it with them so they could see how to do it in the future. The final piece is that follow-up survey, and I should have written that's an education event. It's not just a mail-out survey. It's not a phone survey. It's, again, in the home. What questions did you have? Did anything break? Is anything not working? And just kind of that education bit to make sure that they're still doing it, to see how it's going, and to just keep that local knowledge going. So the energy fair, that was the first time people are hearing about this project. We engaged people of all ages. We tried to get every community group involved. And it really wasn't hard to get people to show up. It's not like we had to pull a lot of strings. They heard, okay, here's a program that's going to help me on my high bills. Here's how I go and sign up for the home visit. So the local crews would make presentations, would give people the first hand, here's the knowledge, here's the energy and information you need. They'd work hard to get people of all ages involved, and we had a lot of success with youth. It's not just because it looks nice. It's a great way to get the people in the homes reminded on a regular basis, and the schools were getting involved, the youth clubs, so it was a really good way to keep that going in the next generation. And the communities, they recruited everybody in the community to get involved. There was a lot of excitement. So the excitement's building in the community, and that's when we started with the freight was coming in, so they're seeing this huge pile of boxes showing up and getting organized. Then we would have the tools, and all the crews were getting recruited locally at the same time. So the crew leader is hired first, the crews come on second. We have between 6 and 10 people hired in the community for this event.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I hate to slow you down. You're really moving good here. But you $300 for each home, and you've got huge boxes of this stuff that you're bringing in. Does that $300 include the shipping it out there? And another question would be, are you buying this stuff locally? Is it coming from the Lower 48, or where are you getting it?
Thank you, Representative Peterson, through the chair. Great questions, and things we all thought about. The $300, for the most part, includes shipping. It kind of varied a little bit by region, but that's on average across the state. We did everything we could to buy as much as we could in the state of Alaska. Part of that was expediency. We wanted things to be ready for us as quickly as possible. So if we could get the supplies here, we got them from the state.
Okay, great. Thank you.
It also included getting tools and safety equipment for the crews, getting them lined up every morning, and doing some hands-on training with the crews. So this is a very important part. We wanted everybody to feel really comfortable with what they're going to be doing in the home. Our staff would fly out for a full week for launch week. We would walk the crews through a series of trainings, including practicing installing everything and practicing with all the education pieces. We generally start with a home of an elder so that the elder would get to kind of introduce the program to the community and get some local support. Kilowatt meter, I'm sure many of you have already seen these, but they're very useful, small $18 to $20 meters that show what an appliance or electronic device uses. And there's a lot still out in the community. A lot of libraries in the communities or tribal councils now loan those out so people can continue to use those. We also worked with the crew so that they knew how to read the energy bills and calculate costs and how to explain PCE to residents. There's a lot of confusion about how PCE works. We wanted to sit down with the residents, go over their energy bills, talk about where they're coming from and what the different costs are. The crew leaders were obviously the leaders of the crews, and they were teaching and practicing all the installation. So here they are practicing some installation of window film. So once the crews got this week of training and new information, then the home visits began. And as Kathy was saying, we would send crews out in groups of two homes, and they would do the installation and work with the residents for the day. Again, it's very important that the residents were there. This was not something done to their homes while they're gone. It was something done with them. They signed up for it. They scheduled it, and the crews would show up, work with the residents. We had a six-page guide that would walk the crews through the whole entire home visit, and it collected a lot of good information, but it also just forced that conversation about different appliances and different costs that they're seeing, and it really was that detective hunt through the home of what was really costing them the most. So So the crew sat down with the residents, as you can see, many times it's multi-generational, and showed them how to save energy and how to save money. They did the calculations to show, you know, not just kilowatt cost, but to put it in real terms. They went over the energy bills with everybody. Again, this is something I've found a lot when I'm in a home in rural Alaska. They'll bring out the bills and just say, why is it costing so much? And you're in a very small home, and you just, you know, can find the big screen TV that's maybe on a lot. And if you show them with the kilowatt meter what that is costing, that led to a lot of behavior change. And here we are with, you know, just an action shot of the crew member testing some of the appliances. So very simple changes, swapping out those old incandescent lights with CFL bulbs, sealing some leaks in windows and door jams. This is, of course, not replacing weatherization, but houses are shifting. It happens so quickly, and we were mostly targeting the big things. We were looking for where snow is blowing into the home. We were in a lot of homes where, in the Arctic entry, we had to shovel snow away to get to the door jam. So these are, we're not worried about oversealing the home. We're worried about filling up some of those gaps. Applying window film, again, a very low-cost thing you can do. It is seasonal. We showed everybody how to do it. We provided them with the supplies for the year, and it saved so much energy just to seal up those leaky windows a little bit more. Testing lots of appliances. You know, most homes have multiple refrigerators and freezers, and just cleaning those refrigerator coils and showing residents how to do that, leaving them with a brush, showing them what their older appliances are costing and how to maybe consolidate as you, you know, have two half-full freezers, how to make it into one and what that will save you. It was really helpful for residents to see that. And doing some minor maintenance on these appliances can really help. So we taught that too. There are some big gaps in insulation, such as electrical outlets and light switches often are skipped. So we had some insulation pads you can install so easily. And then simple things, depending on the community, those that do have running water, we had water heater blankets, and also taught a bit about maintenance and efficiency of maintaining your water heater. There's a soap-up valve. It's a real quick switch you can flip off on your shower head, and it just saves you a little bit of hot water. But you do a dozen of these things, and suddenly you're saving quite a bit of energy. And while we were there, we did some safety training and indoor air quality education, including carbon monoxide detectors and fire extinguishers. So here are the results I was talking about earlier. And yet, when we get down to the energy and money saved, that's the big one, right? We had some reports right away from people saying, hey, my electric bills are going down by $20 to $30 a month. And then there are many residents who have not been eligible for any other services in the past, and they're reporting electric bills going by down by half or more. We also heard from residents that their homes were warmer. We got thank you notes from people just saying, I sleep under the window, and just with that window film, it made such a difference. There's less wind. There's less snow. It's just making for a better life. So we did those follow-up surveys with that third educational visit. We had about 700 completed surveys come back out of 1,000 households, so that's a pretty good sampling. And that's 3 to 6 months, and generally closer to 6 months after that initial home visit. 86% of those people are still practicing the energy efficiency measures. 80% reported the electric bills going down, and a little bit higher, 82% saying their heating bills have gone down. Okay, that's good to hear. Well, let's make sure we know that it's actually happening. So the total cost of this program, including the supplies, the travel, the training, the management, it's about $2,000 per home. The conservative report that we have right now is that people are saving at least $50 a month. So residents are saving about $600 a year in their home heating and electric bills. And the PCE cost, and I'll get to some more of that math in just a few slides, it's gone out down for the state about $468 a year. So our project payback is less than 3 years. So from the 12 communities that we served, their average electric bill over the 12 months would be $186. $63 of that is paid for by the resident. The rest is covered by PCE. So you can see to the far right there the rates on average for those 12 communities that we were serving. And we did target those communities that had high energy costs and high PCE rates. But the average that the resident is paying is about 22 cents per kilowatt hour, and the average for PCE is about 43 cents. After EnergyWise, we saw a reduction of at least $20 for the resident in the electric bills. The state is saving about $39 when the resident's saving about $20. So that's a great drop per month on average. And just for those of you who are more visual, the two towers, the one shrinking, that's after EnergyWise. So that's after we've been there. Okay, so our request that we submitted to the state of Alaska is for $1.96 million. And RoralCap, as Kathy has mentioned, we're working with all of our partners to leverage $1 million and match. We already have a commitment from NANA for $860,000 to do homes, over 600 homes. So we are looking to fill those, that remaining gap. We have applications we've submitted and others that we're working on for HUD, Department of Labor, Department of Energy, and the Coastal Impact Assistance Program. So we're working to leverage some matching funds so that we can get to 1,500 homes. The goals we're looking for 2011 to starting hopefully this late summer or fall would be to get to 1,500 homes in 10 to 15 communities and to have 150 local residents that we hire and train and get certified and then do the work. This is a little squashed. this is our budget. It's real simple. About half of the money goes to local hiring. About a quarter of the money goes to supplies and shipping, and about a quarter goes to the logistics and management. Having that money go to local employment has, as you know, such an impact in those communities to get people employed, to get the money flowing through the local economies and then through the hub communities. We know that when people have an income coming in, it has such a ripple effect to the health of that community, but also to their buying power to be able just to not only save on their energy bills, but then buy the supplies that they need for their family. So here's, I like math and I like going through the numbers, so hopefully this isn't too much all in one slide, but what we're trying to talk about is the residents are saving $50 a month in heating and electricity, so $600 over the course of the year. We know, and just to be conservative and not to inflate the numbers, we know we have about 86-85% of the people who continue with these habits 6 months and on after the initial project. So we're looking at $765,000 in savings for residents by participating in this program and following through per year. For the state, the PCE reduction at $39 per month, 1,500 homes, 85% of the people sticking with it, we're looking at $596,000 in savings. So if you add those two together, we're looking at an annual savings of $1.3 million. If it's $3 million to start, we're looking at a payback of between 2 and 3 years. That's pretty quick. The good thing about EnergyWise and a lot of this behavior change is it doesn't stop in 2 to 3 years. It just keeps going. So everything after that is just gravy. And that's...
I believe we have somebody online. Is that Diana Ramuth? And I believe she's with your group. Diana, are you there?
Hi.
Hi. Did you want to add to the presentation? And if so, if you could please identify yourself and your affiliation for the record.
Hi. This is Diana Ramuth. I'm from Selawik, and I was a recipient of one of those, one of the programs that was one of the villages that got selected because we have a really high cost of electricity and fuel oil, and two of my sons got hired with this program, so they called me and asked me if they could do a training, have my house as a area, so I allowed them to do that, not really knowing, you know, the program itself. So after they did their program here, my son would come home every day. They did their training here. They went out and started working, and my son would come home every day and tell me, you know, what I think I know who that person with the coffee pot is, how he was like, oh, I'm going to turn my coffee pot off now, because and she was shown how much electricity her coffee pot would work. But I really would like to thank RoralCap for bringing it in, because I really benefit from it. Because of the savings, I used to have my electric bill would be somewhere near around $400, because I would keep my heating tape on for my water and other appliances that I wasn't watching, you know, where I kept things all plugged in. And the savings is even higher than my dividend. So I'm not receiving disconnect notices from AVAC. My bill would be so high, sometimes I would get behind during the wintertime trying to pay for the fuel, oil, and my electricity. Last year, or the other year, my electric bill was so high, it would come near the 400s, or near 400, 370, somewhere like that. And from the education I was getting from my son that was coming home, and he would tell me his experiences on certain appliances. And I started watching my, my appliances, and not only that, my water heater, and ever since that program, my bill haven't gone up past 200, so my savings are really higher this year because of the knowledge that was given to my sons who's passing it on to me, and I appreciate that a lot because, I'm no longer passed through on a lot of bills. I just want to thank ROLCAP for bringing in this program because I have not seen any kind of program with this, working on it this way, because it benefits our elders, it benefits our youth that are learning. And there's not only like a few people working, but a whole group that work together, and they learn themselves, they get educated, and a lot of them learn to work with their, like Kathleen and Ellen said, that our behavior at home. So thank you again. Thank you for allowing me to share my personal.
And thank you, Diana. I believe we have a question from Representative Peterson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to, first of all, congratulate you on the success of this program and let you know that this is one of the most successful programs I've seen a presentation on since I've been in the legislature, and I can see why it's working so well. Your enthusiasm that just shows through greatly, and so I want to congratulate you on that as well. My question is, the jobs that are being created, are these permanent full-time? In other words, are they just for one summer while they're working in their own home community that they have this job, or are they going from other communities to continue this employment?
Thank you, Representative Peterson, through the chair. They are temporary positions that we, for the most part, mostly people are working with us between 8 and 14 weeks to get this program going in their community. We have had some outstanding crew leaders, and when it makes sense and we're starting in a community nearby, we've brought them in to help train the new crew. So as much as possible, we've tried to replace, hiring a new person in Anchorage and flying them out with using some of those skilled crew leaders out there. And what we're working on right now with weatherization, the housing authorities, and others is to kind of build a network where they know who's been through our program, what training they've received. We do everything we can, just make some letters of reference and get them ready for those other jobs that are coming out there. But with our program, it is a temporary position.
Okay, great. Thank you.
I always like to, on that point, mention that when you add one job in a small community, just for take example, one job in a community of 100 people, you scale that up 100 times, it's 100 jobs that you'd be adding to a community the size of 10,000, and that's pretty substantial for a small community. And so, Representative Sadler, do you have a question?
Actually, yes. So this question is for Ms. Remus online. You were fortunate or smart to have two sons in the program, so I'm glad to hear things went well in your house. Are your sons, would they work in this program again, or are they taking the skills they learned and applying them to other jobs?
Well, one of them lives in his own home, so I'm sure he's working with his what he's learned, his practice. But he works seasonally. He's not the program, but he works at the AVAC. He's part-time there, but the other son has moved to Narvik. So it was a temporary job, but I, from watching them, I realized how much they, you know, look at things differently as far as saving, trying to save money and using energy. And not only that, I believe the homes that got benefited, you know, that cost every month that the we're able to save, we bring it back to our local economy where we're able to spend it on food or something else we need. That's the big savings on my part when I look at it. It's with my electricity over $100 and maybe $40 with my fuel, so that's almost $200 a month that I'm saving.
Yeah.
And with, you know, and there's, imagine how many homes are doing that.
Yeah, I suspect your son in Norvik took this skills with him and did that to his own home too.
Oh yeah.
Thank you. Are there
the one that's really good with math, and he was the one that really comes home and tells me how much appliances are using in a year, and he was like, "Mom, look at your catering and plugged in. Look at how much it's, you know, how much it's using." And just his everyday learning would he would bring it home and just look around in our home, and he would tell me that.
Real good. Representative Sadler, do you have a follow-up? Are there any other questions? Co-Chair Pruitt.
Quick for the presenters. The information that you guys gave us, the 2,000 that you served, that was for this last year or the last couple years?
Last year.
Okay. And I guess one of the concerns that I just will have is the money that you guys have gotten from the federal government, any concerns that you might not be able to get that this year with some of the I see you partner with Denali Commission, and I don't know that they're going to have some of the money that they've had in the past overall, not just for specific programs. Is there any concern about that for you guys?
Representative Pruitt, through the chair, are you referring to the $1 million match that we're trying to raise?
Yeah.
Right now, we do already have a commitment and next week a contract with NANA for $860,000 of that, and the applications we've submitted to the other the rest of the list there exceed the. So we kind of have to get like one out of three, and feeling pretty optimistic.
Feeling pretty good.
Yeah.
Okay. Good.
Just quick thank you. The 1,500 homes that you would want to target, do you know, identified what region or what communities those might be?
Thank you. Representative Sadler, through the chair. Our intent is to have an open application process for communities and regions to apply, and that we would evaluate that with regard to their need, in addition to the amount of partnership or resources they could bring. But this is partly why we wanted to bring it to the state, because not every region has the resources that NANA would, and we know that other regions would tremendously benefit. And so if they can have some support from the state and other partners to pitch in, then this would bring it to scale more across the state. So, yes, we would look at a fair and open application process.
Mm-hmm. Good. Well, good. Further questions? Seeing none, that wraps up today's hearing. Our next meeting will be on Tuesday, March 29, and then we'll take up at that time House Bill 197, which is the Home Energy Rating System by Representative Pruitt, and also an update on the Alaska Standalone Gas Pipeline by the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation. And if there is no further business, this meeting will be adjourned at 4:59. Thank you, everybody.
Justin.